You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or link from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host tonight is Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And our special guest tonight is Rosalind Peterson. And Dr. Eric Carlstrom is a professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using soils and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And before introduce our guest, the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And tonight we have back a really special researcher and guest, and I'm going to let her describe herself again, even though her credentials are quite great for the subject that we're going to have tonight. And this is Rosalind Peterson again, who has a website, californiaskywatch.com. And are you there, Rosalind and Dr. Carlstrom?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, I'm here, Melody.
Okay, great. And did you have anything more you wanted to add on your experience, Rosalind?
Well, one of the things that, of the many subjects that we may discuss here this evening, is I wanted to talk about my background with agriculture. And I worked for the United States Department of Agriculture in California. And what I did is I was a crop loss adjuster, which meant that I traveled to 10 counties in the state of California checking on crop losses in the state for about 50,000 miles of driving a year, doing this adjusting for the state. And during that period of time, I had become concerned that weather modification and other programs may be interfering with the microclimates that allow for the production of agriculture, the amount of rainfall, and the amount of snow that we need in order to produce crops in California and elsewhere in the United States. So I just wanted to make sure that my background here comes from agriculture and crop production so that your audience would know that a lot of the things that I've been studying and researching are based on preserving the food we eat and the amount of food that is produced in the United States. And that when we interfere with that in artificial ways, then that's going to impact all of us in the short term and in the long term.
Well, Rosalind, if I could jump in on that note, you mentioned you were working with the USDA as a crop loss adjuster. What years are you talking about when you started to notice the possible effects of weather modification on agriculture in California?
Well, it was after I had retired. I started in 2002 to really come into understanding that weather modification was really taking place in the state of California and other western states, and began to really understand that we had been modifying our skies with man-made clouds, which was interfering with direct sunlight reaching the earth, which could reduce crop production in the United States and in California. And so I was contacted by several agricultural producers that I had met along the way who were very concerned because their crop production was dropping or they were having drought conditions and didn't know why. And so we had discussed this on numerous occasions, and that's when I started to really heavily research in weather modification areas.
Okay. Now, you talk about man-made clouds and reduction of solar radiation or sunlight. There are other people that have noticed a phenomenon called global dimming, and I've heard figures of, say, 20% less sunlight. over a period of some like 20 years. Does that sound about right to you?
Yes, there's less sunlight definitely now reaching the Earth than in, say, 50 to 100 years ago. And we're beginning to interfere with the amount of that sunlight reaching the Earth. And one of the things that has happened in the last 20 years has been the introduction of persistent jet contrails that produce man-made clouds, which, according to NASA, aggravate and exacerbate global warming, change our climate. They produce a white haze, and they impact natural resources in a negative way. So we do have the NASA studies and the IPCC studies from the United Nations saying that aviation is having a critical effect on, in other words, our climate.
Now, you just mentioned the IPCC, and that, I believe, stands for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a United Nations, actually a political body. It's comprised of government representatives, and they go out and find scientists to write their assessment reports, and they have four of them now. Most recent one came out in 2007. And these IPCC reports are the basis for the global warming scare, or at least a big part of the global warming scare that the media and the politicians have picked up on. Now, I'll just mention that last week we had an interview with Dr. Tim Ball here with Melody, and we've had two prior interviews with him. I've also done a lot of research on this whole issue of climate change over long periods, and really, we old timers like Tim Ball and myself and some of the other people that have studied climate change, natural climate change over the not just centuries but millennia and millions of years timescales, we are quite certain that this whole man-caused global warming thing is pretty bogus in the sense that there's really very, very little data to support the idea that humans have caused and are causing the climate to increase in kind of an abnormal way. In fact, we see very little warming, and probably the humans burning fossil fuels has contributed to very, very tiny fraction, if any, of that. But anyway, I say all that simply because the IPCC is the political United Nations political body which has promoted this idea of man-caused global warming, and given the politicians the leverage, the so-called data support they need to introduce the energy bill, the cap and trade policies, etc. Now, going back, you said the IPCC also made some comments about these persisting jet contrails, is that correct?
Yes, they've talked about, there's a book called Aviation and the Global Atmosphere, and they talk about water vapor as a greenhouse gas, mm-hmm. and they talk about the impact of having water vapor in certain areas, like Alaska, which definitely has an impact in other words, keeping things warmer, kind of a blanket over the Earth in those areas. And they're talking about increasing levels of water vapor over Alaska and the Arctic, which would actually cause them to hold heat in and melt more rapidly. Now, and one of the things that they talk about is that the persistent jet contrails tend to form this cloud cover, man-made cloud cover, and white haze. They consist of water vapor and ice crystals, and what they do is they can hold the heat in certain areas. So you could have some climate change in other words, this increase in cloud cover. And so we're concerned about this because we think that it's also blocking direct sunlight from reaching the Earth. And this cloud cover, when it blocks direct sunlight from reaching the Earth, negatively impacts crop production. Now, we know that from University of Illinois and other studies that have been done recently, that without direct sunlight, you have a lack of photosynthesis and your plants don't grow as well. So the problem in some areas is that once you start cutting off the amount of direct sunlight reaching the Earth, which is a suggestion for these geoengineering schemes, to put up particles or to put up things in the sky, in other words, carbon black, for example, or sulfur, different types of chemicals. Some of them you would find when a volcano goes off, in order to cool us down, have negative effects because they can lead to acid rain, and they can also block the direct sunlight reaching the Earth, which could lower crop production and causes other difficulties as well. And when you have increased cloud cover, you do change the climate. And when you change the climate artificially, then you begin to upset the microclimates needed for crop production to take place. And you can change, when you add this process to weather modification programs, which are ongoing in the United States and in California and Colorado and Idaho and Wyoming, when you and Nevada, another state that's modifying its weather a lot, then you begin to change agricultural production in those areas. And our government agencies don't want to talk about this. And so this is part of the area that I'm really researching in, is this area of how we're modifying or planning to modify what we do in our atmosphere. In other words, so that we stop direct sunlight from or reduce the amount of direct sunlight reaching the Earth. And I have grave concerns about that because we do need vitamin D and we do need direct sunlight in order to reduce molds, mildews, and fungus, and also to allow direct sunlight to come down and allow for the plants and trees to gain the energy they need to grow and produce crops.
Well, of course, we know that the entire biosphere runs on sunlight. That's the energy source for all living things, pretty much, except for a few life forms that are near the ocean, deep sea ocean heat vents. But, you know, 99.9% of all the energy to the planet, which drives the weather systems, drives the biosphere, is from the sun. So if we start to tamper with the amount of incoming solar radiation deliberately, this doesn't sound good. This doesn't sound like a good thing. Let me just, before I ask the next question, let me just link back to the clouds. Now, I teach climatology and introduction to physical geography and that sort of thing. And we teach that about 50% of the globe is covered with clouds at any given time. Clouds occur in many different types, the low level, the middle level, and the high level clouds. And clouds have been one of the things that the computer modelers, the climate modelers, have not been able to model successfully because they are so complex. And but in general, one of the things that has come from the studies in climate change and global warming, et cetera, is that low clouds, like cumulus clouds, which are very bright on the top, tend to reflect sunlight back and therefore would have a cooling effect on the Earth. But high clouds, like the cirrus clouds, which are in the upper part of the atmosphere or upper part of the troposphere, would tend to absorb heat from the Earth just like a greenhouse gas, and then tend to hold in the heat like a blanket. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the modelers were caught and very puzzled, saying, well, we know clouds are the wild card in terms of predicting what future climate's going to be, and it kind of depends on whether we have more cumulus clouds, which are the low clouds that reflect sunlight, or the cirrus clouds, which absorb heat radiation given from the Earth. So it would seem that if these man-made clouds mimic cirrus clouds, then they would have the effect of actually trapping in heat and warming the Earth. Now, does that sound right to you?
Absolutely. And the clouds that we are talking about are cirrus clouds. They are the higher clouds.
This is
of great concern to NASA and some universities in studying this in recent years, because they really feel that there's more of these man-made clouds. at the higher level that are produced by jets, and that this is not good for us because it doesn't allow the heat to escape from the Earth as readily.
What part does the this play in the ability to utilize solar energy with the equipment that we have these days?
Well, a friend of mine who lives in Shasta County built a solar house, and one of the regions that's heavily hit by these man-made clouds on a pretty consistent basis year-round is Shasta County near Redding. And what's happening there is his solar panels lose production when these man-made clouds are present, to the point where sometimes he's almost dependent on electricity for running his house versus being a place where solar would run his house all of the time without any use of electricity at all. So this has really changed his thinking on this, because when the man-made cloud cover is over, covering the skies, cirrus clouds, white haze, all of this, his solar production can drop up to 50-60% at times.
Yeah, I would just mention that this is one of the articles that you sent me, Melody, by Dane Wigington in Shasta County in August 11, 2007, called Diminished Solar Charge Capacities Due to Persistent Jet Contrails. Now, he does have a background as an electrical engineer, and he's got a lot of experience trying to get solar with solar off-grid electricity production. And he's been thwarted in his attempts by the degree of artificial cloud cover created by these persisting contrails, sometimes called chemtrails. So, and I would just mention at this point that there are now several good DVDs and videos available on this subject, and I just ordered three. One's called Skylines, which is a short documentary by Deborah J. Whitman. This one mostly documents what's going on in California, and it also features Rosalind Peterson. The other one, and this is coming mostly out of the California Skywatch group, I believe. There's another one called Geoengineering by the New York Skywatch group, which is also extremely informative and actually more technical in terms of explaining what could be going on in terms of weather warfare capacity technologies. And then there is a recent History Channel program called Weather Warfare, which aired in July of 2009, 45 minutes long, which is excellent, showing how the weather can be used for purposes of warfare, and our government has certainly been interested in these potentials for a long time. All those can be bought at Sophia Small Storm's website, and perhaps Rosalind can tell us where else they can be got. And this guy, Dane Wigington, who is the electrical engineer concerned about solar energy, he is featured on the Sky Lines video, talking to a group up in Shasta County, kind of, it looks like a county board of supervisors, trying to get the county board of supervisors to analyze the water for the heavy metal content. Maybe could you tell us a little bit about those attempts, Rosalind, to try to get county and state officials to wake up to what's happening here?
Yes, I can. I do know that that's a Board of Supervisors meeting in Shasta County that Dane was speaking about, and they've been finding very high levels of aluminum and barium, strontium, and other chemicals in snow samples and drinking water samples, as well as pond samples in that area. And I did a research and obtained from the California State Department of Health Drinking Water Division in Sacramento, California, a CD of all drinking water tests dating back to the 1970s, done in the state of California. It's about 18 million bytes of data. And those tests, anyone, by the way, can get a CD, get a copy of this information free from the California State Department of Health Drinking Water Division just upon request. It's very easy to get the data. And what happened was I did a study of the data to figure out if I could find what it was that people were talking about, what was spiking in drinking water supplies. And these tests are from every drinking water source in the state of California as required by law. So every county, every city, every drinking water source, whether it's a winery or a well, that provides water to the public for public consumption has to be tested under California and EPA regulations. So I took a look at all of that data, graphed a great deal of it, and what I found is we had unusually high spiking in barium, aluminum, manganese, magnesium, arsenic, strontium, and boron. There's a few other chemicals that are very odd to be spiking in. But the main spikes that started occurring were in the 1990s, around 1990, 1991. We began to see unusual spiking of these chemicals, all at the same time, would spike in almost every drinking water supply source in the state of California. And this coincided with other spikes that were occurring in other states as well. So we took all this data and put it into a graphing program, which took about 300 hours to do. And we really examined the spikes and the correlation between the spikes in different areas of California. And we can tell you that there's extremely high levels of aluminum and barium, manganese, magnesium, strontium, that are spiking in California drinking water supplies at various times. And we've correlated it to some atmospheric testing that has taken place that is being done by NASA and the Air Force in conjunction with the University of Alaska, that they've been putting up these canisters filled with these chemicals, superheating them, exploding them in the atmosphere and doing these atmospheric tests. And these tests of these chemicals that are put up in canisters by the space shuttle or by rockets are beginning to show up as spikes in drinking water supplies in many areas, and we think that the testing correlates with the spikes in our drinking water here in California.
Okay, well, you gave a clue there. You mentioned the University of Alaska, and we know that the University of Alaska is involved with the HARP facility, which could provide a tie-in for what is being done by the Air Force and NASA. Would you care to elucidate on that? Or do I need to?
Well, I think you're going to have to because I'm not an expert in HARP. I've refrained from going in that direction other than to know the bare minimum of what HARP does, but there's not a lot of documentation. There's some, but not a lot. And we don't know, because it's not public record, all of the different projects that they're engaged in. Although we do think that they were engaged in the recent Navy putting up a aluminum oxide cloud on the West Coast on September 19th. And we do think that they were engaged because of the reading I've done with that program. And we're doing some heating of the atmosphere possibly during that time period when this aluminum oxide dust cloud was put up into the atmosphere, and that there will be continued tests going on for the next several months with regard to that dust cloud that was put up.
What do you think they did that?
Well, let me just explain HARP before
okay.
we go that. A little bit. HARP is a series of about 360 towers, 72 feet high. HARP stands for the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. Now, of course, Alaska is a good place to study the aurora borealis because near the poles you have a lot of ions in the atmosphere, and these are electrically charged particles that give us the aurora borealis and the aurora australis in the southern hemisphere, etc. So HARP is a research facility with a number of co-sponsors, including the U.S. military, the Air Force, as well as private corporations. And they are using patents from a guy named Eastland that are pretty much identical technologies that Nikola Tesla discovered about 100 years ago that have to do with directed energy using different portions of the electromagnetic spectrum. What this can do with this array of 360 towers, they can send off pulses of extremely low frequency radiation. They can lift the ionosphere. They can send these pulses over the horizon. They can bounce it off the ionosphere because the ionosphere is one of the upper levels of the atmosphere, and radio waves bounce off the ionosphere. By sending these pulses of electromagnetic radiation, HARP can actually lift the ionosphere create a bubble in it, thereby creating somewhat of a vacuum in the lower atmosphere, and then air has to rush into that. There's also a suggestion that HARP could teleguide the jet stream, storms, could be involved in, even mind control, because they talk about the frequency of brain waves being about the same as the potential frequencies that HARP can use. So anyway, the other movie, the geoengineering movie, was saying that one of the projects that is probably being conducted with these so-called chemtrails or persisting contrails is to lay a grid down of these chemicals, like you say, these metals, which then HARP can use to determine where to send the signals. And one of the goals would be perhaps to steer the jet stream and to deflect large storms. So if HARP, if the plane is putting down a contrail along a front boundary, that is a boundary between a warm front and a cold front or something like that, air masses of dissimilar air masses, then HARP could send the extremely low frequency energy pulses that could actually add energy to one side or the other and deflect the whole system. So this is one potential use of these jet contrails, is to allow HARP. It ionizes the atmosphere in a sense. It increases the electrical conductivity of the atmosphere with all these metals, and it allows the electromagnetic radiation to have more of an effect when it is directed in those areas. Does that sound roughly correct to you, Rosalind?
Yes, it does.
Can I ask, you say it's called a high frequency, but you're talking about low frequencies. Do you know why they, why would they call it high frequency and they're using low frequencies?
Well, it's High Altitude Aurora Research Program.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought it was, too.
So it's high altitude where they're doing research.
Okay.
Well, it's not a point that I can really add much to on that. But I can tell you that there are at least five such installations around the world. The one near Golconda, Alaska, is not the only one in the world. There's, I've heard, between 5 and 12 others. And so when you start to put all of these stations together, they have great potential for manipulating the upper atmosphere and our weather system. And of course, a lot of this is experimental, and a lot of it has potential military uses, or else the Air Force probably wouldn't be interested. Okay, so having said that about HARP, maybe we could get back to this Navy program that you were talking about, because you mentioned there was a connection with HARP there as well, Rosalind.
Well, what happens is that they want to know, in other words, there's ionospheric experiments going on all the time. The CRES program, C-R-R-E-S, NASA and the Air Force's CRES program, is doing these different ionospheric programs in order to study more and more about how the universe works. Well, this is all well and good, except that the chemicals they're using we think are beginning to show up back on Earth here and causing water pollution and soil pollution. In addition, the experiments, it's kind of interesting when you talk about the CARE experiment, because
the Navy CARE experiment.
Yeah, it's a charged aerosol release experiment, and the principal investigator, which is a Paul Bernhardt of the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C., they're talking about what kind of information you get back when you send out radar pulses into this aluminum oxide dusty plasma that they have created. And essentially, what they're doing is they're talking about having the CARE experiment paving the way for future launches of this type of, putting up this type of dusty particulate that would use the uppermost part of the Earth's atmosphere as a large physics laboratory for studying charged dust and other experiments. And this is what concerns me, because the environment that we live in other words, the ionosphere and all these different levels of protective cocoon that circles the Earth, if we start using them for experiments in a physics laboratory, we could destroy the very nature of life on Earth here if we were to disrupt one of those, because they're fragile and they're not tough like they would be resilient exactly. And the more experiments we do in those areas, the more likely it is that we can cause some harm to come to the Earth. And if we put up dusty plasmas and aerosols of different types that are going to eventually come down, we're going to disrupt the amount of sunlight that reaches the Earth. We could be doing other harm to the environment. No one knows. And so all of these experiments, no one is studying agriculture, no one is studying the amount of direct sunlight reaching the Earth that could be impacted by these tests. No one is really, they're looking at the experiment for the sake of using our atmosphere as a physics laboratory, but without our consent or in knowledge for the most part. And that's another great concern of mine.
Do questions come up in these meetings when they're talking about global warming? Does it ever come up that any of this is going on?
No. No, because you see, U.S. Senate Bill 1733, which is the new energy bill, it's the cap and trade bill, it's the reducing the carbon dioxide bill, essentially. When they go in and talk about this bill, more of it is about employing new nuclear power plants. It's about using our trees as credit offsets for polluters to give off more carbon dioxide and to be given or purchase these credits so that they can keep on polluting, which to me makes no sense at all. But when you talk about these other experiments that we're doing, whether it's weather modification experiments, whether it's these atmospheric experiments, whether it's persistent jet contrails that change the climate, that isn't in the bill. No one wants to talk about those subjects. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison's U.S. Senate Bill 601 wants to allow more weather mitigation and modification by everyone without any public oversight or control or congressional oversight or public notification for that matter. So that's why we've been working to defeat that bill for the last several years each time she introduces it. So once again this year, for the first time, it's gotten out of committee and could be passed at any time. But
Yeah. It,
when you have U.S. Senate Bill 1733, which is an energy bill, but it's supposed to fix the climate and to reduce global warming, we don't talk about these other experiments that we're doing in the atmosphere, which could have an adverse effect or could be causing us some climate problems.
But they don't hesitate to kind of dump the blame on the public.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Correct. And what I think is happening here is that we can all say, yes, in other words, we pollute, we do different things. But then if that was the problem, then all they have to do is put the EPA in gear, find all the polluters, and use the money for less polluting alternative sources of energy and investment in new technology, And they could save their, they could do something about it relatively quickly, just like they did in the 70s and 80s. But that's not the goal here. The goal here is a market scheme. And it's nice to say to all of us, well, we all have to take personal responsibility, which I find fine. You know, creating less pollution is okay. But what happens is nobody is looking at the weather modification programs and the synergistic effect of these. There's over 60. The list is NOAA public listing, U.S. Department of Commerce listing that's public record. We don't know what the synergistic effects of those and how they're affecting agriculture and climate. And when we talk about man-made clouds and these cirrus clouds affecting climate and changing climate because these jets produce more of these clouds for whatever reason, they don't need to, then what we're doing is we're changing our climate. But you see, none of this is talked about in any of this legislation that is coming up. It's all talked about that there's only one culprit, carbon dioxide, when actually they've got six greenhouse gases. But they're not talking about that either. So the bill is disingenuous in many ways.
Well, it's fraudulent in many ways, I think. You know, and the thing that Dr. Ball and I and many of our colleagues would say about that is they've completely ignored the role of natural climate change. And we know enough about the past history of the Earth to know that natural climate changes are dramatic and much larger. They can be much larger than anything we've seen in the last few centuries. And so it's an attempt. I look at it now as a little bit like the book 1984. Remember, Winston Smith was with the Ministry of Truth, and it was his job to rewrite past newspaper articles to fit the present needs and dictates of Big Brother, who's of course the socialistic government of England, with the caveat or with the excuse that, you know, whoever controls the present controls the past. And so what we see with this whole climate research, quote-unquote, is that if we can control the funding, who gets funding for what, we can ignore the vast amount of research that's been done on paleoclimates, climates of the past, and rewrite the past to fit our present agenda, which becomes then a form of scientific censorship, which is what I'm feel like I'm struggling against, because this is the area of my research. And I've done a lot on past climates, and I know a lot about past climates, but it would seem that the so-called experts in control don't want to know anything about past climates. They want to think that there was no change in climate until humans started driving cars and burning fossil fuels. Well, that's just ludicrous. So I'm hoping that the emperor has no clothes will become increasingly obvious to people who still can think. But meanwhile, we've got these other issues which you're tackling, which I think really are of major significance and are very, very concerning. And I'll just say that John Holdren, our czar of science, has recently said, oh, the problems of global warming are so dramatic that we better start some geoengineering technologies to counter the runaway warming of the planet. And of course, this would be then a segue between the programs, I guess, would be, oh, now this gives us an excuse then to go ahead and continue to modify the weather like we've been doing for 20 years, only we're saying we're just starting it.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And also, we don't take into consideration that every so often volcanoes go off. And when they do go off, they release a lot of particles and chemicals into the atmosphere, some of which create acid rain. But they work toward cooling us down as well. So we don't know, because these different volcanoes and these different Earth events are also working to change, in other words, the climate, and to change what's happening with our environment. And so now all of a sudden we say, well, we have to take these Stanford University professors like Ken Caldera and Professor Benford of Irvine University are talking about using these experiments now that they've been playing with on their computer models to start to experiment with them more and more to determine how we can change the environment we live in by putting up particles, for example, in the atmosphere, so that we can do more of these charged particles like aluminum oxide and put them into the atmosphere so that they can conduct their experiments. I don't believe it's for our own benefit. I think it's for a military application and to continue funding their research from the Pentagon and other military sources of funding that the universities get now at this time more and more versus other types of funding which would be independent of the military complexes that are now highly engaged in this type of atmospheric physics experiments.
I believe in the geoengineering DVD that I just purchased, put out by New York Skywatchers.com.
Yes.
They showed an experiment in which you had a cloud or a bunch of water vapor and water droplets in a cylinder, and then they introduced some of these metals, aluminum oxide, barium, strontium, etc. And what they found was that the cloud dissipated, and the moisture dried up. And this, I think, gave them the idea that perhaps this is a way to create drought. This would be one of the potentials for this kind of addition of chemicals to the atmosphere, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And that was talked about on the History Channel program as well, giving these experiments that they could do. And I thought that test actually was very revealing in the fact that this water vapor, dissipated. But I think that the experiments have been ongoing for some time. The public just hasn't been made aware of them. And now it's come time that they want to roll through the global warming crisis so that they can begin to really come forward with public knowledge about these programs and that the public will think that it's so beneficial that they wouldn't object. And I think that that's been the objective.
Do you have any idea how long Colorado has had a weather modification department?
Ooh, I don't know. I would imagine since NOAA arrived and put headquarters in Colorado, and I'm not sure when that was. I'm sure that they could give you a history of that very easily. The NOAA people could give you a history of that. But they've been modifying the weather in Colorado going back to the 1940s, as far as I know. That's the earliest research records I have for Colorado.
And do you know of many other states that have it?
Yes, almost all the western states, with the exception of the state of Washington, because of treaty agreements with Canada. I don't have any that they're doing. I don't have any that Oregon are participating in at the present time. And let's see, Arizona does not seem to be participating at the present time in any of these weather modification programs. However, the rest of the states, California, Nevada, Colorado, Wyoming, Texas, all the other states, Montana, are all having some weather modification programs ongoing every year. According to U.S. Department of Commerce records, I can send those to you if you need them.
Okay, and wouldn't some of these programs offset each other? In a sense, you could almost have weather warfare among those that have these programs.
Yes, because when they instituted in Wyoming the biggest weather modification, it's a five-state, $10 million a year program, and it involves five states. And they decided to put more snow in the Wyoming mountains starting in the winter of 2006 than ever before in recorded history. And they have done that. But what they started to do from that was put surrounding counties in Wyoming into drought status. And also Colorado has now been having more droughts than ever before, even though they've increased the number of their weather modification programs. And when Ken Salazar was a senator, I discussed that with his office quite strenuously, that Wyoming snowpack project, which actually was designed to take all of the extra water runoff from the snowpack and supplement water in Southern California. That was the goal. Maybe, and it still is the goal, actually, that Colorado started to have more drought and more problems. And I was concerned that the people of Wyoming and the people of Colorado wouldn't know about the weather modification programs in that state and not understand why their weather was so different and why they were in these droughts or had too much rain or too much snow in some areas. And so that's one of the reasons that I started to object to these experimental weather modification programs, because the people weren't even notified. They're not. There is no U.S. requirement to notify the people, nor state requirement, except a limited in Texas, that requires anybody to be notified that these programs are taking place.
Well, one of the things that there's a group of us that have kind of looked at certain events taking place around the country, and we started noticing that sometimes there was a weather overage of either drought or rain in some of these places, that there might have been some commercial interests or governmental interests that could be interfering. Are you following what I'm talking about? Say, like with the Trans-Texas Corridor, it was interesting that for that month about a year or two ago, it was like there was a front that, you know, parked itself there for almost a month. And then when Coca-Cola was having some things going on with the Georgia, they were going through a drought. They were going over having problems with feuding over the water, if I understand it correctly.
Well, the only thing is that anyone can modify your weather at this particular point in time. Any individual, any company, any state, any city, any county, anyone. I could hire somebody today to go and modify the weather over Colorado if I chose to, or over anyone. And I could disperse your clouds. I could put chemicals up, any type of chemical, any type of ground-based chemical, airborne chemical. I could put anything into the air I wanted, even experimentally, and there would be no restriction against it. And so I could do what the Dynagel Dynamat Corporation did and took a polymer and put it into an airplane and sprayed it into clouds, and the polymer soaked up the moisture in the clouds, dissipated the clouds, and the gel fell to Earth, which has detrimental effect to living things on Earth. But what happens is that right now, unless we get control of this particular problem, we're going to face more and more of this in the future, and also the HAARP project could superheat, for example, air masses, or they could put up carbon black as a particulate up into the air and superheat it, and could create weather fronts. And you can change temperature. They know that changing temperature can hold a front in one place for a long period of time. So I actually think that we're experimenting in many, many ways in using the atmosphere as this physics laboratory, mostly for military use later. But I really think that we're experimenting on us at the present time.
Rosalind, are you familiar with a video or DVD by Tom Bearden called Soviet Weather Engineering Over North America, which he made in 1985. It's a talk he did in 1985 where he talks about using HAARP-like Tesla technology that the Soviets were apparently, according to him, using all through the Cold War. While we were so concerned about nuclear technology, they were moving right into Tesla technology, which actually is potentially much more destructive. Are you familiar with that movie?
I never saw the movie, so I'm not familiar with
the
movie.
He talks about the woodpecker signals that they would send, and they'd do these over the horizon radio waves and electromagnetic, extremely low frequency pulses, and that they could divert our jet stream, and they could create storms in certain areas, and that they were doing it. And he gives lots of examples. So I think that's something you might want to check out at some point, because if this is true, the U.S. government was playing catch-up to the Soviets during the late 80s, and the Soviets were ahead of us when they fell apart in 1989.
Well, I do know that they were using Project Woodpecker. The only thing that I cannot lay my hands on are the actual documents that would hold up in a court of law. And that's what I try to look for when I start talking about these projects, are the actual documents that would hold up.
Right.
So that they're not just theories.
Yes.
I can back them up with some credibility.
Right.
And that's harder. There's a lot of speculation, and there's some things that they speculate about what was done. But sometimes I can't get to the document itself or the series of documents which really show exactly how it was done and what it and what was done and when.
Right.
So that's that. So I try to separate that out a little bit.
Well, I think that that's a connection, perhaps, with HAARP and with Tesla technology that we should be considering, because you know, Tesla said if he interfered two electromagnetic waves of just the right frequency, he could split the Earth in two. So we're talking about the power to create earthquakes. We're talking about power to move hurricanes. We're talking about power to create huge earthquakes, and even potentially to, as Tesla said, split the Earth in two. So technology potentially more powerful than any nuclear technology that we know of. Now, if I could shift gears, I got this great little card here. It's called the Independent Thinkers, quote, Chemtrails Fact Sheet. Have you seen that?
No.
Okay, this comes out of www.aboutthesky.com. I got it from Sophia Smallstorm's website. And it's 10 points here, and I wonder if I could just kind of go through these real quick and get your comments about them. I think it gives some of the high points. It starts out with pictures of what you're calling persisting contrails, or persisting jet contrails. Some people call them chemtrails. And it says, have you noticed airplanes leaving white plumes in the sky, often in grids? These trails widen and spread out, forming layers that look like clouds. Soon the sky is overcast. Here are 10 points to consider about this phenomenon. Number one, current U.S. Senate bills are seeking to pass weather modification and weather experimentation policies to engineer and control our weather. And you've already mentioned U.S. Senate Bill 601, which you identified as the Kay Bailey Hutchison bill.
That's correct.
Yeah, and you've already mentioned that. Number two, the jets that spray aerosols in the sky have been seen all over the world. No governments or official agencies have been willing to discuss this activity. Now, I've seen some reports that say this is mostly going on in NATO countries, i.e., Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, and then I've heard other people say it's all over the world. What is your understanding of that?
My understanding of that from talking to people is that it's more heavily used, I think, in the NATO countries, although I have people from Mexico and South America calling me, and from countries that are not involved with NATO as well. So, and they send me pictures, which tells me that it's going on almost all over.
Okay.
The one sentence I want to say is that when anyone says that something is being sprayed, and that there's a spraying going on, I can't prove if anything is being sprayed. I can't prove what it is. I have no way to prove that. I would love to, but I have no way to prove that they're spraying something, and what the something is that there's that these jets would be spraying to make contrails persist. I can't go there because I can't prove what or who, and that is the sticky issue there.
Well, let me just say that the geoengineering film is a little more bold as to say that there are 740 U.S. Air Force jets that are that are unmarked that are available for this, and they include KC-135s, which in fact are old Boeing 707s that can hold 130,000 gallons of liquid. They also include KC-10s or DC-10 airlines, which can hold twice that amount, and that these planes can hold between 10,000 pounds and a half a million pounds of metals, and that they are probably Air Force vehicle. Is that a little too bold for you as a statement?
Only about the number. I can't prove a number.
Uh-huh.
And I can't prove which branch of the military. I suspect it may be the Air Force, but I can't prove the branch of the military. And if they're spraying something, definitely it would be showing up in the water supplies across the state of California, because the jets are working over California quite heavily. And the test results from the water supplies, and I have the current ones even for this year, and I can find the spikes, which are unusual and go up, but then I find too many zeros, which leads me to believe that either and I can find other sources of the chemicals that are showing up in our drinking water spikes. So I'm having a hard time correlating what the jets may be doing.
Okay, well, the point number three is that the content of the sprays includes fibers, metal particles, and biological elements, including fungi, many of which are microscopic. These microparticles enter our bodies, eluding our immune systems and impairing our health. Some of the particles are artificially engineered and self-replicating. Could you comment on that?
I can't prove it. The only thing I can prove is that all the branches of the military service release flares and chaff. Chaff is aluminum-coated fiberglass that they use for tracking weather patterns and also for disrupting radar. Now, chaff, the particulates from chaff are coming down. They float in the air for about 20 hours, and then they do come down, and the Air Force readily admits that they use chaff. The other branches of military in other countries also readily admit that they use chaff. So chaff is something that the Air Force and the Navy and the branches of the service release about 500 tons a year worldwide. And so we do know that. I can prove that.
Let me go ahead and do a station ID. This is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And we are past programs like tonight's, and the one that was referred to earlier with Dr. Tim Ball is on www.givemesometruth.info. And our co-host tonight is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our guest is Rosalind Peterson, and we're talking about chemtrails and naval experimentation and numerous other related subjects. Okay.
Yeah, let me just go back to this 10 points. But before I do that, I'll just mention some of the websites that are mentioned on this card. In addition to www.aboutthesky.com, there is also carnicom.com, newyorkskywatch.com, bariumblues.com, don'tchemtrailmebro.com, iclines.com, and then, of course, there's the californiaskywatch.com, which is your website, Rosalind.
It shouldn't be on that card.
It's not on this card, and you say it shouldn't be on the card because?
Because some of the statements therein I cannot prove.
Okay.
And
okay.
So I try to keep what I can prove separate from what other people may speculate on or believe based on ground-based tests. But a lot of ground-based tests could show a lot of things that are in the air, and you could find all kinds of things floating around. So I don't know that they're directly related to the jets.
Right.
So I have to stick with what I can prove.
Okay, very good. That's fair enough, and we appreciate that. I will say carnicom.com does go into the fibers and the biological elements, the fungi, et cetera, more. Okay, number four here is the metals in the sprays are ionized, electrically charged. The air we live in now is a plasma, able to conduct energy. It has been weaponized. Would you agree with that?
I think that there are some experiments, like the Navy CARE experiment, that are ongoing, which talk about negative and positive charge particle experiments, which is one of their experiments with the CARE program. So I can say that, yes, they are experimenting, and we don't know what the health effects are from being exposed to those type of particles, especially when they're aluminum oxide particles.
Yeah. I recall from our last interview you did say that with these metals in the water conducts electricity better, and the same would also be true of the air, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, and that
okay.
could be why we're having more lightning strikes
yeah.
than ever in recorded history in many areas of the United States.
Well, this is what this guy, Dane Wigington, is talking about, and he's, of course, an electrical engineer. He's talking about the electrical potential of the atmosphere being some four times greater than it was before, as I recall from his article there.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, number five here is the spraying has saturated our atmosphere with particulate matter that has whitened our once blue sky. Visibility on the Earth has been greatly reduced. A direct data-based correlation exists between particulate levels in the air and our mortality. Would you agree with that? Because you talked about rickets showing up in the last couple decades in much greater numbers than prior. Is that right?
Well, if you take jet fuel emissions, that would increase asthma in children in the United States. Jet fuel emissions are highly toxic. Soot particles, much like diesel trucks, carcinogens are released by the jets. So you have jet fuel emissions, which could be the source of many of those particulates and soot and different things that they release as part of the normal process of operating airplanes and jet engines. So I can say that from the source of jet fuel emissions and EPA reports in that regard. So, yes. Now, as far as rickets, that's a lack of vitamin D, and that's when you obscure... in other words, the sun from hitting the earth, then you have, you start to interfere with us getting enough vitamin D when we're outside because we are in cloud cover a lot of times. So the increase in rickets, even the CDC and the University of California Berkeley studies will say that that's from more cloud cover. And so children are not getting the vitamin D that they did years ago when they used to play outside because we're having this cloud cover put up by these jets producing these persistent contrails that produce the man-made clouds. And water vapor right there can be one of the culprits in that, too. And it would be reflective as well.
Well, I guess I should mention, as a guy who teaches about this stuff, that... when you put particulates in the atmosphere, and of course there are natural particulates in the atmosphere, soot and little pieces of dirt and whatnot, little floaties that get in the atmosphere, these little particulates, natural or man-injected, all have the same ability to act as what we call condensation nuclei, around which water vapor condenses into water droplets. And when water vapor condenses into water droplets, and you get enough of them, you have a cloud. And so there is a direct correlation then between the amount of particulates in the atmosphere and the cloud cover. And, of course, this is the basis of cloud seeding, which has been going on since the 40s and 50s. So, okay, we'll move on to number six here. Dangerous levels of aluminum and barium have been found in soil and water samples nationwide. Both elements are highly toxic. Our rate of respiratory illness, allergies, Alzheimer's, and cancer has risen exponentially since the spraying was intensified in 1998.
I think that the persistent jet contrails actually began to show up around the late 1980s, 1988, 1989. So it's been a much longer period of time. And so I would say that, yes, we've had spikes in aluminum and barium, but I can't directly associate them with a JET program.
Okay, how about associating them with our rate of respiratory illness, allergies, Alzheimer's, and cancer?
I think that all of our atmospheric experiments, including having more persistent jet contrails that expand, I think that all of those started to increase around the late 1980s, around the same time that we began to see the jets leaving persistent contrails. But also that's when other atmospheric experiments were taking place with NASA and with the U.S. Air Force. So they all started, there began to be a whole series of experiments at different levels doing different things that I think have all contributed to some of our problems since the late 1980s. And that includes increases in asthma in children. That includes the increase in rickets. Lots of things started to change, and air quality started to degrade about that time rather rapidly.
And we've heard speculation that aluminum, concentrations of aluminum, may be one of the causes for Alzheimer's disease. Is that correct?
It may be, and there are some studies which reflect this, and there seems to be some conflicting reports, but prior to the time that aluminum appeared in our drinking water, we seem to have fewer cases of Alzheimer's and some of these other diseases that are now showing up. So I think you have to look at the dates that these really started to show up in the population. In other words, the more general population. And I think that 1988 was a key year for that, along with the changes in forest fire configuration.
Okay. Okay, and then number seven is the spraying is a global covert operation. It is capable of engineering and controlling storms, planetary moisture, and the Earth's electrical balance. It can manipulate radio frequencies and the electromagnetic spectrum for military and surveillance purposes. It can alter human awareness and behavior.
I can't comment because I don't have the direct documents which would take me down that path precisely. And so I'm not even going to comment on that one because I can't relate it all to the jets. I think there's other experiments going on would affect us in that manner.
Yeah. Well, of course, this would implicate HARP. Now let me just mention a couple other resources for people who are interested in following up, and I just happen to have these books. There's a guy named Bob Fracekas, who is a journalist. He's got a book called The Fracekas Files, Star Wars, Weather Mods, and Full Spectrum Dominance. There is a book about HARP by Jerry E. Smith. It's called HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. And then there's a book by William Thomas, Chemtrails Confirmed, and another book by Jerry E. Smith called Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. So there are others who certainly make those connections, and those are some of the books that would talk about it. Okay, then there's number eight. The spraying typically creates cloud-like masses that spread to form a, quote, sky shield. This sky shield is responsible for, quote, global dimming, now being presented as an antidote to global warming. According to NASA, the world has already seen a 20% loss of sunlight. Okay, we talked about that, and that we can kind of agree on. Is that right?
Yes, but they still refer to the jets spraying something, and I would certainly like to know what it is that they are spraying.
Yeah.
And I'd like to have, you know, if anyone has the government documents, anything that would hold up in court, I would be happy to take a look at it because this is the kind of documentation I'm looking for.
But the problem, of course, is these operations are classified, and the government, the military does not admit that chemtrails exist, per se, and does not admit to these programs. Isn't that much of the case?
That is the case, and that's why even when you deal with things that you can prove, our elected officials don't want to touch this topic. They don't want to touch aviation. So the Air Force has done a good job at preventing any of our elected officials into really looking into the programs that they might be engaged in, or it's so classified that when they're briefed, they can't talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And I think some of this stuff is probably classified at levels that are above our congressmen, which is an interesting commentary right there, that we have people who whose clearance levels are greater than our congressmen. In other words, who's running the show here? Number nine, HARP, and here they do define it, Melody, as the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, is a military surveillance operation that generates electromagnetic frequencies. The combination of HARP activity and the atmospheric spraying may be producing, quote, climate change, a phenomenon blamed on nature's response to, quote, runaway global warming. Our environment is deliberately being altered. Okay, so that that connection we've talked about a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, number 10, these programs are operating without our informed consent. Their agenda may be the total control of biology, ecology, and the Earth. To this end, our, quote, destructive human ways, burning fossil fuels and overpopulation, may become the pretext to re-engineer nature as a means towards planetary, quote, sustainability. And that's a very interesting possibility, but I don't imagine you want to touch that one either, huh?
I'll touch it. Sure.
Okay.
I don't disagree with it, except to the fact that I don't think that they're going to engineer us into sustainability.
Right.
I think that it's for war purposes and full spectrum dominance, which is one of the military's, Air Force's favorite phrases. And so I think that this has got to do with wars in space. I think this has got to do with, in other words, this military aspect of it. And I think that a lot of the universities are now geared toward working toward these experiments with the for military applications. So I'm not so sure that they want to sustain us as much as they want to conduct their experiments. And they've got the money and the technology now to do it without any government public oversight to any great respect. The other thing is that, and it's irritating to me, is that not all of our elected officials that go to Washington, D.C., and that is our senators or our congressmen, are briefed on all of these issues. You have to have special clearances, and only one or two or three may be briefed. How do we know that we can trust them that if something is wrong, that they would speak up? Because under the Supreme Court decision, Senator Gravel and all of our senators since that time, he won his lawsuit, and the Supreme Court said that he could talk about classified, any senator could talk about classified material that they were going to vote on the floor of the Senate. But our senators are either given the material and our congressmen, and they can't talk about it even to their colleagues or to anyone. So therefore, if they object to it or have any comments, they can't represent us. The rest of them are not given the information, and therefore they don't know what's going on, so they can't object to it either. So there's something about representative government that has been lost in recent years because of the way they classify things, and that there are laws which says, yes, they can talk about classified material, especially when they're going to vote upon it. Well, a lot of times in the legislation that our elected officials vote upon, they don't even know what the classified material is that they're voting upon. So they can't speak to these programs and properly represent us. And I think there needs to be a shift here so that we become engaged in the process and not cut out of the process because of these rules.
Now, we know that Congressman Dennis Kucinich tried to introduce a bill, I believe, to the House back around, 2002 or 2003, that would limit weather warfare and warfare from space, but this bill did not get through the House. Is that correct?
That's correct. They changed the bill because the Pentagon wouldn't allow it to go through within its current wording form. So what happened is that because it was classified, they stripped the language out of the bill, and then it never went anywhere after that. But I think Dennis Kucinich was introducing some of what our government is working on and talking about, and a lot of it involves space, which doesn't surprise me, knowing what I know about some of the programs we're doing now.
Well, during the 1980s, some of us who are have been, you know, been around for a while remember that the government put an enormous amount of research dollars into the quote-unquote Star Wars program that Ronald Reagan envisioned, you know, this shield that would protect us from the nuclear missiles of the Russians. This has morphed into what we call the Strategic Defense Initiative. So you see a potential connection then between this Star Wars research and what is going on now?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And could
We have the money and the technology now to do it, and I think that that's some of the reasons that we're doing some of the experiments, atmospheric experiments that we're doing, is because we want to figure out how to do all of this. And so I think that it's definitely a military application.
So do you have any of that information on your website?
I will later this week. The CARE program is going to go up, and one of the things that the CARE program talks about is they want to protect, in other words, if someone put up some sort of explosion in space, that they wanted to protect their what they call our satellites or space assets from, in other words, this type of attack. And I looked at this, and I thought to myself very strangely that, well, if someone did that kind of attack, their own equipment and their own satellites would be just as disrupted as ours. So I felt that there was another reason for what they were trying to project here as far as why they were doing the CARE experiment. One of the reasons they were doing the CARE experiment. The University of Virginia has quite a lot of information on that, and I'm going to put it all up later this week on the agriculturaldefensecoalition.org site.
And that's the one that you were speaking of earlier that I asked the question on about took place in September. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So all my research is going to go up on to the agriculturaldefensecoalition.org site, which anyone can go to now. It has about 8,000 documents on it at the present time, and we're going to be adding another 18,000 within the next 2 weeks or so.
If I haven't got you linked, I'll certainly try to get that up there.
Okay, because you can go and you can do the search engine. Right now there's 325 articles about the U.S. Navy on there. There's Air Force articles. There's climate change articles. There's EPA, jet fuel emissions articles, all kinds of things on that website. And you can either scan it by page and then click on anything that you find of interest, or you can just type in words in the search engine and it will come up.
Well, if I could just go back to this weather warfare or space warfare connection, weather warfare, space warfare connection, do you envision that it's possible that a satellite could send electromagnetic weapons or beams, beam weapons down to a ionized plasma area of the atmosphere where they had done a lot of the additions, and that this could then what would be the effects then? Do you have any sense of how that would work?
I think that it would be devastating. They could pinpoint anyone anywhere on Earth and just in other words, just wipe them out. I think our technology, when you look at our weapon systems now and what we're capable of doing and the rush that we're putting through on some of these new systems, which is bothering me as well, to do it from space through the use of satellites and different things would be just a next juncture in world warfare and full dominance.
So obviously you found a lot of evidence to this back then.
That they're really interested in working on these things, doing the studies, yes. The universities are heavily engaged with military funding and also private funding in these fields. And if they get the private funding and they find something, it just shoots into a military application almost right away.
Yeah, and I suppose this would be an opportune moment to mention the document of the Air Force weather as a force multiplier, owning the weather by 2025. That's an Air Force document. You can download it off the computer. But there's also all of the Cheney defense directives that came out of when Cheney was defense Secretary of Defense in '92. And then this morphed into the neocon game plan, which I think came out around 2000-2001 under Bush, when Cheney, of course, was the vice president. And in these documents, they talk about, again, full spectrum dominance, complete control of space and cyberspace, having such an overwhelming military capacity that no other nation in the world would even dare to question the military superiority of the United States. So there's lots of documents that mention this goal of full spectrum dominance.
Well, there is this goal, but there's a low tech solution to this, and I've hesitated talking about it on the air, but I think I will tonight, only because the thing that bothers the satellites and it bothers everyone in space is space debris. So anytime there's an explosion in space, then they have all this debris, you know, floating around, which can impact the space station, could impact all these other things. So when anyone talks about having any explosions in space, that's the least that they want to do, because all that debris could bring down almost anything that's floating around and could ruin the satellites or do different things depending on the orbits. So, you know, we're talking about all this high tech and full spectrum dominance, and you know, anybody could shoot a rocket up loaded with rocks and explode it, and I can tell you that the havoc that would create would be tremendous at this particular juncture in time. And it's kind of stunning, but it's low tech, but they are so worried about all these rocks and these explosions. When the Russian satellite exploded and when we exploded one, they're having a problem with space debris. And so when they talk about having all this dominance and having all of these other things and being able to do this, that, and the other, because someone's going to put an explosion up there, I just can't believe it, because it would take down everyone's ability to use satellites and all kinds of things just by having space debris up there.
It would, I've read and heard that if once we get a certain amount of space debris in orbiting the Earth, it will be impossible to have these satellites. Isn't that correct?
It would be impossible, because they would be damaged beyond repair, because they have to be light enough to be able to, you know, solar panels and use the sun and do different things.
It would be colliding with debris that also is up there. Yeah.
Yeah. So part of this is that I think we want to have this dominance and have this full spectrum and be able to do all these things. But on the other hand, you've got other countries who are engaging in the same thing. So, you know, I don't know what the ultimate goal is particularly, except to have a few countries dominate so well that that poor countries and the rest of us become, in other words, chattels of this monumental space thing that we're supposedly doing. And that's why I think that we need to get control of what we're doing in space and these experiments, and stop them before they go into any further, and say, look, we want to be informed. The public needs to decide whether this is a good idea, not just to use a space and our atmosphere as a physics laboratory for experiments. And I think we've gone much, much too far, and intend to go much too much further.